This is The Conversation, a podcast that goes behind the scenes, particularly in this episode, and between the lines of the contemporary art worlds. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's episode 226 with Brigitte Mulholland. She is a director at Anton Kern Gallery in New York. The website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where you can check out images of Brigitte out and about at art fairs, at the gallery, some installations at Chris Martin's studio, one of her favorite artists who she, as she talks about, she gets to work with now, and so much more. In our conversation, we talk about her journey to Anton Kern Gallery, and most notably for a woman, some of the realities of working in galleries still to this day, including some rather invasive interactions she's had with clients, and how Me Too is going to be a little bit slow in catching up to that in regards to some collectors, let's say. And if you're not intrigued now, I don't know what will intrigue you. On the back end, I've got some great Weiss links, including one about Damien Hirst, which will be a nice echo of her mention of Damien Hirst later in the conversation. Also, I want to let you know that Marcus Sivan, guest from last episode, artist, performance artist, and new chair at UNLV Department of Art, has been generous enough to donate 4 artworks to us. He calls them drawings, but I would say they're even maybe a little more substantial than that. One of them is even kind of like a painting on cardboard. The others are more collage-y. You can check them out at theconversationpod.com/support. And I will tell you more about that on the back end. But the gist of it is that whoever donates the most between now and the next episode, or at least the end of the month anyway, will get first stabs at those pieces in order of your donation. So more on that on the back end. In the meantime, let us get to this thrilling and scintillating conversation with Brigitte Mulholland. Thank you very much for being here. Stick around for the back end for more info on the Marcus Sivan artworks and the Weiss links. All right. Talk to you on the back end. So you've been at a director at the Anton Kern Gallery for, is it a little over a year, did you mention when we spoke last?
Yeah, a little over a year. Yeah, okay. It started in May of 2017.
Okay, got it. And
I worked for 2 galleries before this. I worked for a gallery in Chelsea, and then before that, I worked for a gallery on the Upper East Side that mostly dealt in secondary market work.
Okay, that's what it was. That's what I was confusing.
Yeah.
Did you study art history? Was that your specialty?
Yeah, okay. That was it. Okay, I studied art history as an undergrad, and then I got a master's in it as well.
The reason I ask is I'm wondering if, so when you were studying art history, either undergrad or maybe more particularly as a graduate student, were your objectives or ambitions clear as to where you wanted to take it? And where are they now as far as, you know, retrospectively looking back on that?
Mm-hmm. When I started, I had a bit of a circuitous path where I went into undergrad partially thinking I would go into theater, but also thinking I needed something more stable than a degree in theater. And so I decided on art history. Kind of hilarious.
Out of the frying pan and into the fire.
And I had always loved art. That was my thing. I was poring over books about art history on my own in high school and going to the Metropolitan Museum as much as humanly possible, things like that. And so when I found out, like, oh, it's a thing you can actually study in college, I just went immediately into it, fell completely in love with my Renaissance history professor. She became my advisor, and then I just sort of dove into doing that there. And I loved my teachers at undergrad at Manhattanville College. I wound up graduating early. I did it in about 3 years. And in those 3 years, I sort of thought that I wanted to get a PhD in the Italian Renaissance. And also sort of parallel to that, I was like engaged and wanted to get married. And I was going to like move to Maryland and get a PhD and then become like a professor. And about 2 months before I graduated, I realized I didn't want to do any of those things.
What was the turning point that made you have that realization?
like spring break of that year, I just like, I was supposed to like go down to Maryland and like see my fiance at the time and like start like figuring out like, you know, like what, I, like all about the school and all of this stuff. And I was just like, I just had this gut instinct, like, I don't want to do this. So I went, I like packed up the apartment and I broke up with the guy, turned back around, called a friend of mine. And I said, hey, I'm moving to Brooklyn with you guys. And got back to New York, started immediately looking for a job at a gallery. That was always something that like kind of in the back of my mind, I felt like I should do and that I wanted to do. And people always were sort of joking with me like, oh my God, like every time I would say like I was doing art history, they'd be like, oh, you're like Charlotte from Sex and the City, you know? Mm-hmm, But that sort of like that constantly resonated in my head. Like, oh, like working at a gallery, that would be something really great. And so I went on like, I don't want to say like 100 interviews, honestly, and then finally landed at the gallery that I worked for about 8.5 years on the Upper East Side. And dove right into that, really got into it, and started working my way up. And so I wound up going to CUNY Grad Center, still thinking I wanted a PhD, and I lasted about one semester there before realizing I didn't want a PhD. I wanted to really work in galleries, that was something that I was very good at and that I loved, and that if I was going to get a PhD, I would just sort of be hiding in a library for the next few years, and it just didn't like feel like something that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I transferred to Hunter, got a master's there, and continued to work full-time. And then finished my master's at Hunter in modern and contemporary art, and I wrote my thesis on Jackson Pollock.
Do you have any clarity, though? It's such an odd sort of, not serendipity, but kind of gut, you know, that pushed you so strongly in another direction, you know, both with your romantic life and your specialty, you know, your choice of study, you know, as opposed to going the old history route, you ended up in the contemporary area. And it doesn't sound like you didn't sort of make any reference to it's, it almost seems like it was, you were magnetically pulled or something.
Yeah, it feels like that in a lot of ways. And I mean, these sort of like major life decisions never really felt all that major to me. It just felt like a sort of natural progression or something that just very organically, like I had to do. Even like writing the thesis on Jackson Pollock, it was like, I wasn't in agony over it or couldn't figure out what I wanted to do. It was just like, oh, that's like, that's the thing to do. It's this weird sort of trust in your intuition and then just sort of things really appearing and you have to go with that. It's this like, just slowly sort of uncovering who you really are. And I think, I mean, and that's really, you know, it's taken me like 10, 11 years of working in this business to really feel like I'm hitting my stride or to feel like I'm exactly where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, and it takes time and it takes really trusting your instinct and then going for it and not being afraid in those moments.
Is your sense that people who have art history degrees are generally more suitable or at least have better odds as candidates than people who don't?
Not necessarily, but it definitely helps and to be in the field. It's also, though, like, on the one hand, like, you have to know art history, and then as soon as you get into a gallery or a contemporary gallery, you kind of have to throw it out the window. Because so much of it is not based on, like, you have to have the references and you have to have the understanding, but then you can't be taught how to work with a living artist, you know? You can't be taught what the sort of insanity that goes on in the gallery. A lot of it is just diving into the deep end and learning how to swim.
Right.
And really, like I said, like, I started just as a, like, basic gallery assistant and just spent years, like, learning what that was and then, like, slowly moving up. And so then, like, knowing basically, like, top to bottom everything about a gallery and how it functions and just sort of those ins and outs. The art history background helps because it is, you know, we're looking at art, but it's also a lot of, like, people skills. And just, I mean, salesmanship, too, is certainly part of it. You don't necessarily have to have an art history degree. I know plenty of people in the field that don't, but who or who maybe like figured it out a lot later than I did that they wanted to do it, or so they only have a graduate degree in it, but their undergrad is in something different.
Sure.
It's sort of, yeah.
Yeah, no, I just, definitely I just, right. There are plenty of gallery people out there who, who are artists themselves, or, you know, or maybe studied contemporary art, or maybe they just studied history even, you know, or something like that. But when you describe your job search, you know, and even though it sounds like you did do a lot of interviews before you found that one that stuck, and, you know, and you stayed there for quite a while, it still kind of felt like, you know, that you were just, as young people interviewing for gallery jobs, it just seems like having that art history is more attractive to potential employers somehow. I don't know if that's
definitely
a myth. Yeah,
it helps. It's right. Like you speak it's like knowing that you speak a kind of language.
Yeah.
That right. You have a certain visual vocabulary or a certain understanding, and you can contextualize things. It helps.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about your work in galleries, you know, both the one you're with now and then the prior couple of galleries as well. Let's talk first about what you enjoy about it. What are some of the highlights? What are the things that make you keep coming back, as it were, if that's not a weird way to put it?
What I love in particular about working at Anton Kern is that all of the directors, we do both sales and artist liaisons, and it's not separated. And that's something that I really love, and something that really drew me to the gallery and to the position, because a lot of galleries, it's sort of separated out.
Right.
There are some people that just do sales and some people that just do artist liaisons.
Right.
And I think that if I only had to do sales, I would be really miserable.
Right.
Not that I don't love doing sales, but why I'm doing those sales is for the artists. And I also, I mean, I do a lot of like curating on the side and things like that. And I love being in artist studios. I love talking to them and spending time with them, and everything I do is in service of them first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have those relationships is really, really important to me too.
Yeah. Right. Has it ever felt, I mean, you describe and people have described this sentiment before of being very, very much in service to the artists. But for me as an artist myself, it usually strikes me as so serviceable, so selfless, you know, that to what extent do you have to learn that versus that it's just nature, you know, that's kind of the personality that best fits with that kind of dynamic?
It's both. I think there is something sort of fundamental, though, about having this innate nature to be in the service of something.
Right.
Like some sort of higher, it sounds so trite, but something sort of higher, and
right.
Like having that kind of humility, I guess.
Right.
That on one level, like, yeah, you have to learn it, or just learn like what's appropriate and what's not. But then on the other hand, it has to sort of be built into you too. I mean, there are plenty of people I know that just do sales and are just really, really good at sales.
Mm-hmm.
And know how to do that. And that's, I mean, like purely who they are. And that's wonderful.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't want to do artist liaisons because that's just sort of not what they're good at, or that's not quite in their nature. And there's plenty of that on the flip side too. You know, there are a few people at the gallery that don't do sales, but just work with artists. Like we have one managing director who just does like artist projects, and she doesn't want to do sales. And
right.
That's because that's just not in her nature either.
Right. Right.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's a matter of a lot of like finding the best sort of fit for you too.
Yeah.
And what your role is,
mm-hmm.
and what you're good at.
For what it's worth, it just, I know this is really cartoonish kind of portrait mm-hmm. of the dynamic, but when I hear you describe it, you know, without, you didn't get into much detail about what it involves, and I know it's nuanced and complicated, but just on a really superficial level, it kind of feels like the artists are sort of the ego types, you know, and the liaisons, you and your colleagues, are the sort of giving, selfless types, you know what I mean? It's kind of like, you know, you're sort of there to serve the artist. You're there to meet their needs. And, is there any, does that resonate at all?
We're there because we love them. Like, that's the sort of funny thing, too. And, especially at Anton Kern, honestly, like, I mean, Chris Martin has been one of my favorite painters for a long time. And I work with him now. And I mean, it sounds so tacky, but it's like the first time I got a text message from him, I cried because I was just like, wow, like I'm working with someone that I, whose work I love, you know, and he was like a real hero of mine as a painter. And everyone's always like, oh, don't meet your heroes. Well, Chris Martin's amazing. Chris Martin's one of my favorite human beings. Like, and to have the privilege of working with him and not, but not like putting him on a pedestal or anything, you know, but just, it's so pure and sort of the opposite of like what people think of. You talk about the art world, it's all like, oh, it's money. And it's like all these billionaires and auction records and things like that. And it's like, no, actually like the heart of this whole thing is because like there are people who love to make art and people who love to help make art happen and who love to help artists live. And that's why I'm doing it. And that's why a lot of people are doing it too.
That's really lucky that you got connected with him and, you know, that he turned out to be a good guy. I wonder if in maybe prior situations, since he certainly wouldn't want to refer to any, that, you know, with a current gallery, where you were a liaison or had a liaison-like situation and maybe you had expectations or maybe you didn't, but where the artist was not maybe nearly so pleasurable to work with.
Sure, it happens. No one's perfect. Honestly, everyone at Anton Kern, I really love, I really adore. Really, really lucky in that. Like all of the artists and the staff too, like we all have a really, really great relationship. Previous galleries though, sure, there have been some difficult people. I won't name names. Sometimes quite egoic and sort of sabotaging in ways that were very difficult to work with. And even like some artists that you just sort of meet along the way, you're kind of like, ooh, like, I'm glad I don't have to work with that person.
Sure.
And then even on the flip side, you know, like I've done projects with artists or other curators or collaborators where it's been like, well, I'm never going to work with that person again. There's definitely something to like, you can have an ego, you can not necessarily be the nicest person, but if you're just doing it to do it and like just want to have a hissy fit, like it's not a good look. And generally that means that people don't really want to work with you.
Right. But that said, you know, outside of your particular experience in universe, there are certainly those types that manage to stick around maybe after they've gotten enough, you know, leverage so that it, you know, they can get away with it. But in any case,
absolutely. Yeah, of course. Yeah. So, I mean, that's in every industry. Isn't
right.
It?
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. Let's not over talk the obvious. But meanwhile, I think maybe that's a good segue to talk about some of the challenges, you know, again, just to clarify, I get it. It's what you have now is not that. And it's just something you've had to deal with in the past. And, you know, it's something you're aware of, but aside from the whole artist liaison dynamic, just as a gallery director, as a gallery employee, let's talk about some of the challenges. And maybe we can frame most of these challenges, since this is, you know, what we covered earlier in past conversations, as far as the Me Too era. Maybe what would be a good question might be, what has it been like? And this is something that you actually suggested kind of as a framing device. What has it been like as a gallery worker who is a woman over the years?
I mean, we can talk about a lot of that stuff. There's like, I sort of have the reputation at the gallery. Like first we can like segue into the Me Too stuff. Like I'm the person that everyone kind of hands off the really difficult clients to because I just like don't mind getting yelled at.
Like, wow.
If something goes wrong,
right,
and someone, you know, even like the tiniest thing, but someone needs to get yelled at, I'll take the call. I'll just like, I'll apologize for like, and I don't get an ego about it. I'm like, fine, you know, so like people sometimes just need to yell and I'm fine with that. I've also, I mean, there was one collector who I have to laugh about it. And we all like, she was really, really upset because she couldn't buy something that was, it just wasn't available. And but she wanted it. And I had to say, well, I'm sorry, it's not available. And then she got really huffy that it hadn't been exclusively offered to her.
Right.
I mean,
right.
This thing had like pre-sold to someone. And
right.
She started yelling that we treated her like a second-class citizen.
Wow.
And I mean, I kind of had to like bite the inside of my cheeks to not laugh because
yeah.
that was just,
right, right.
That's just absurd.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's, you know, that
it's sort of, yeah.
Yeah. So I have two mm-hmm. related questions. The first one I'll hold off for a second, but it's about whether you need thick skin, and maybe you can tie this into your answer, you know, at working at a gallery, especially when you're getting yelled at. But going to the point about the collector first, does that at all have a similar protocol or pattern as when you are dealing with the difficult artist, you know, who eventually sort of, you know, you don't have to work with anymore? Can you put on the future blacklist when a collector becomes difficult, or is that just unwise for so many reasons?
I've never had to put anyone on a blacklist, really. It's more like if someone, you know, if someone like flips something, then it's like, well, no, like
right.
that's something that we're very like, you don't do that.
Right.
And we won't sell to people that are known to do that or who have done that. That's
right.
just a huge no-no.
Right.
And that's really in service of the artist. Like, we put them first. We won't sell to people that we know to be bad. Often, you know, like, we'll hold something if we can't find the right person for it. If someone, you know, like, there has to be that level of trust between us and the artist, because without them, the gallery doesn't exist.
And right.
Anton, especially, you know, he's been doing it for so long, like, he knows and trusts that, like, the long term is way more important than just a quick sale.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The artist is generally, you know, they're usually right. That's sort of our MO. But when it comes to clients, like, Anton really has everyone's back. He really does. And that's something that I have to say is very rare, where he really, like, if he trusts us and he is not going to, you know, put some collector's, like, weird egoic thing ahead of his own people.
Mm-hmm.
That's just not what he does. Yeah, like, we can segue into this story that I've told you and two other people at this point. Like, I had an incident where it was really early on in my time with Anton, actually. And there was this collector who wanted to buy, who seemed very real. And he, you know, he is a real collector. I know he collects. I've done my research on him. And he wanted to buy a painting by someone who the gallery really doesn't sell very much. And it would have been like a huge deal for me to make this sale. And it would have, you know, and I was really like, really, really trying to prove myself and like, really like, you know, like show Anton I could do it. And we have weekly or maybe bi-weekly sales meetings where we just sort of update each other on the status of things. And at a certain point with this sale, the guy was like sort of hitting on me from the get-go, which is kind of normal. Like, there's something, and I sort of like let it roll off my back a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes it's very benign or just sort of like, oh, you know, like, you're just sort of, it's kind of part of sales. It's just like being really nice to people. And some people maybe take it too far. And this guy kind of took it too far. And at a certain point, it was becoming very clear that, like, he really just, like, was holding this sale over my head as a way to, like, you know, like, try and sleep with me, basically. And after a few weeks, Anton, we were having a meeting, and he was like, okay, what's the deal? Like, is this guy going to buy it or what? Like, why hasn't this closed? And I was so upset by the whole situation. I was really, really frustrated and flustered, and I kind of just went, I was like, Anton, I was like, the thing that's going to get him to close the sale, I'm not going to do. And I'm trying to find another way of doing that. And he kind of looked at me and like did a double take. And he was like, oh, if that's what's on the table, then forget it. Like, don't even bother.
Wow.
And that was such a relief to me in a lot of ways, because I've heard so many stories of galleries where that's not the case. And like, plenty of owners would be like, well, you're going to, you know, like, come on, close it then. And he just immediately was like, oh, no, 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 no. And he was sort of surprised that that was like a thing that would even be on the table. And it was just, you know, like, he sticks up for his people, and I really, really appreciated that, I have to say.
Mm. When you had that exchange with Anton, was that, I clarify, was that in a meeting with the group of people, or was that just the two of you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and one of my female coworker was like, I knew it. I knew that guy was up to no good.
Right.
And I was like, yep.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So then would he become blacklisted then?
We're very open with each other.
Would he become blacklisted then?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to... If he wants to buy something, he can buy it, like at an art fair or something. But I don't really engage with that person anymore, and I won't.
Right.
I also, like, you know, I even, like, after, especially after that interaction, I contemplated, like, buying a fake wedding ring to wear to art fairs and things.
Yeah.
And a bunch of my female friends said not to bother, and they're married. And they said, oh, you shouldn't bother because it's probably just going to encourage people like that anyway.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lose-lose situation.
<I know>.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
So that happened. That happened about a year. Did that happen towards the beginning? So like 9 months or 10 months ago, something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm just one. So that was kind of before the Me Too thing broke. So I wonder, you know, I mean, what is your sense? It might maybe too early, but what is your sense? The way that is affecting or not affecting collectors, clients in the art world in terms of that kind of behavior?
Well, notice that, like, no collectors have been called out, really.
Yeah.
It's curators, it's publishers, it's people of significant power, but not people with money.
Right.
And honestly, like, you know, I'm not going to, like, name this guy's name. I'm not going to, like, it's not, to me, a big deal. And it's sort of benign in that way. I wonder if any collectors will get called out. I don't know of anyone personally, like, I've heard some stories here and there, but I don't really have any firsthand knowledge of anyone significant. I just don't know. I wonder, a sort of cynical part of me is like, no one's going to get called out, even
right.
if they're like just the worst, the absolute worst. It's not going to happen.
Right.
Well,
you
we'll
said,
see. I mean, maybe.
Well, you said you used the word benign, and you also said it's not that big a deal. I guess it seems that for you, that you can sort of chalk this kind of scenario up to, you know, an old tradition, an old and you know, misogynistic or sexist tradition that's
yeah.
gone on for a long time. So the other side then, I guess, it would no longer be benign if that person or another client like it or him would engage in... you know, sexual harassment of some kind.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And then the complexity though is because of the context, it sounds like it's pretty benign because it's happened so long and it's kind of been so part of the routine. But if it was in a different context, let's just say, I don't know, maybe some typical vaguely progressive workplace, that kind of the language, you know, would be borderline, verbal harassment, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And I guess I say benign because, you know, it's like, for me, it's one collector out of many that I deal with. It's this sort of annoying, stupid situation, but
right.
it wasn't like violent. It wasn't, you know, I mean, there was another incident with a curator that really shook me up. And that was one of the first times that had ever really happened to me. And that was something that was very eye-opening for me. This curator, like, basically, who I had, I don't know, maybe two or three interactions with at an art fair over the years, like, sort of tried to use his relationship with one of the galleries I was working for at the time as a means basically to start an affair with me. And I was very, like, blindsided by that.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of, like, pushed me to go out for a drink with him. And I was just sort of horrified by the attempt and, didn't tell anyone for the longest time. I just internalized it so much. And I mean, eventually I told one friend who was a gay guy, and he just looked at me and he was like, oh, honey, every woman in the art world has a story like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a couple of years ago, to be honest. And that was sort of the first moment where I was like, oh, okay, like, this is really systematized and, mm-hmm. and normal and part of it. And I suppose I still sort of speak from it being normal because it still is. It's changing a lot, but it's not, you know, like really systematic abuse of power, abuse of women, that definitely has to go. And then there's this sort of like everyday indignities that suck.
Yeah.
But that's going to change. That has to change over time. You
sure.
know, that's not going to be like some sort of, the Me Too movement can help, but it really, you know, that's going to take years to sort of clean out
mm-hmm.
the things that are just built into dynamics between men and women in general,
right.
not just in the art world,
sure.
but everywhere, really.
Sure. This, sorry yeah. if this is a little pedantic, but just to clarify,
mm-hmm.
when this curator in particular, or you can use other examples, how is it clear that there's a difference between asking you out for a drink, you know, just to kind of talk and hang out versus the more invasive variety?
But because he literally like said to me, well, as you know, I have many affairs.
Oh,
and I was
geez.
Like, I don't know that. This is the first time I'm ever talking to you for 5 minutes.
You should know this about me.
I kind of leaned in and I was like, wait, what?
Right,
okay. You know, I mean, that's like, I have drinks with plenty of curators and collectors and artists, and it's, you know, like the art world is wonderful for that. It's like a very social place and there are amazing people and you can have drinks with men and women, married, unmarried, and it's like purely like friendship
sure.
and work relationship. And then
right.
in that obvious situation, we're literally, that's what he said to me.
Wow. Well, that,
yeah.
that's not ambiguous at all. So I
no,
get it.
No, it's not.
I get it. Right. Okay.
Yeah. No ambiguity there.
I wanted to ask you about something that we alluded to briefly before that was really intriguing to me. And that is working with artists in the past where you've had to be honest with them about I'm not sure if it was that you were no longer going to be working with them or if you wouldn't be able to work with them in the first place. Because I remember a line along the lines of, I'm sorry, but your work, you know, just isn't good enough or something along those lines. Do you know what I'm referring to?
When I started getting involved in the like more contemporary scene, I was doing a lot of independent projects. And you know, like where I started and where I am now are very different.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's always sort of been, I mean, there are a lot of people that want shows and things. And sometimes for friends of mine, let's say, like there are friends who like want to do work with me or, and I do have to sort, I think it's a friendly thing to say like your work's not there now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I won't say that necessarily to anyone because I am friends with a lot of artists and
right.
they'll ask me for advice or they'll ask me like, I mean, there are some people that will point blank be like, will you put me in a show? Will you do a show with me? Will you come to the studio? And at a certain point and where I'm at now, I do have to say no. And then I have to be pretty honest with them. And again, that's not with everyone. There are plenty of people that I also have to say, like, I love what you're doing. It's just like not the time for it. Or,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm thinking about this, you know, it's on my agenda, but I can't do it now. But like, I want to, I think the work is great, but there's nothing I can do for you right now. That kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of different sort of nuances with that and with the things that I'm capable of doing outside of work and even inside of work too.
It seems if you were friends with an artist, that it would be perfectly acceptable and reasonable even, you know, of course, depending on your availability, which I know is limited, but for the mm-hmm. for them to ask you to come to their studio. On the other hand,
yeah.
on the other hand, for them to actually say, will you put me in a show? That's completely unreasonable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even the studio visits at this point, sometimes it's like, I have to really take my, like, I have to really be kind of picky about it.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Even if it's people that I'm friends with, because like I don't have time, you know,
right,
like
right.
I'm working. I basically work every day and then
mm-hmm.
I still, even if I'm after work, I'm at openings or I'm still sending emails trying to sell things at like 11 at night.
Mm.
So So my time has to be something that, you know, if I'm taking it, I have to be really interested in the work. And even on a friendship level, like if that's something that's going to be meaningful to our friendship or to whatever.
Right.
And then on the other, yeah, I mean, but like blatantly asking me to do a show, that's just not, that's not okay.
You know, as you're saying, yeah, absolutely. As you're saying this though, yeah. I'm wondering if, let's just take one of your, you can picture any one of your artist friends, right? Mm-hmm. And if they were to say, if they were to make the more reasonable request, you know, I'd love to have you by the studio at some point, maybe that would be an opportunity to sort of educate them a little bit, you know, because if you could educate one friend, they would be able to pass that along and that would, you know, eventually reach a fair number of people. Just simply the etiquette, you know, whatever you believe mm-hmm. proper etiquette is. And also if you are friends with somebody who is a busy art professional, that you're welcome to ask them for advice. Maybe you can ask me for advice. I'm fine. I'm happy to give you advice and insight, but you have to understand how limited our time is and not to take it personally.
That's exactly it. I've said that to a few people actually mm-hmm. at this point, mm-hmm. even one friend who, as soon as I said it to him, like this light bulb went off in his head and he was like, oh, wow. Like I never really thought of that. Like I never really thought, you know,
yeah.
like
yeah.
it's going to be, you know, it's not just like a quick little studio visit. It's like, oh, it's an hour to get here. It's an hour at least in the studio, if not more. And then it's an hour back. Like that's a huge chunk of someone's time and, mm-hmm. and mental energy as well. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, like we really, you know, arts, like especially people like who are directors of galleries or curators and things, like we do a lot. We have to do a lot. And part of it is like, you know, you're working basically 24/7. And so I think respecting that you're asking someone that and even just understanding that goes a really, really long way.
Yeah.
Even among arts professionals, like, I've had conversations with other directors of galleries who are asking me for like advice or insight into certain spaces or curators or things like that. And I'm happy to give it. And it's like one person in particular just profusely kept thanking me for my time. And that was so, I thought it was just so sweet. And it was like, wow, he really understands, like, yeah, like, you know, we talked for half an hour out of my day. Like that was a pretty big chunk of time. I was more than happy to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And him being that appreciative really made, like, it was just so nice to be like collegial in that way.
Yeah.
Right. It felt really, really good. And that he understood that made me, you know, want to talk to him even more, to be honest.
That's so great.
Like, oh, you know, like he respects it.
That sounds like a great interaction.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. And to go back to my earlier question about, so I have two questions about, mm-hmm. about the work that you do, which I want to get to how intense and intensive it is in terms of time. But going back to my earlier question about having thick skin. So you mentioned that collector who yelled at you for treating her like a second-class citizen and, mm-hmm. and also yeah. being so willing to be the one who gets yelled at. So first of all, do you personally have a thick skin? And secondly, do you think that people who work in galleries should have thick skins, and how many of them actually do, based on your experience?
Mm-hmm. It's sort of funny. I'm like extraordinarily sensitive, but I also have a thick skin.
Wow.
And so I think you do need to have a thick skin. You need a thick skin because, I mean, on, you know, you need the ability to just keep going. There's an art advisor that I work a lot with and that I'm also very good friends with. And there was a certain point where just everything that we kept trying to close wasn't going through. And I joked and I was like, geez, to think that, you know, I didn't do theater because I didn't think I could take all the rejection.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, there's that, but you need a thick skin. A lot of time, you just need to not take things personally.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when it comes to clients. I mean, people can be really, really difficult. A lot of things are at stake. A lot of money is at stake.
Yeah.
There are times, I mean, there was one client that there was a bit of a misunderstanding with, and I kind of had to push back at him. And after that, it was like, now we have like the best relationship. Like we're super tight.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, not, you know, you can yell at me and I'll let it roll off my back, but at a certain point, if you're wrong, I'll push back. And that's something that's really important to know too. It's like, you do have to have a thick skin and you have to be unafraid to, you have to sort of know when it's right to let things go and when it's right to not be a pushover.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're talking,
and it's tough.
Yeah. It sounds tough. I mean, it's really hard for me to get wrap my head around that you can both be really sensitive and have a thick skin at the same time. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But I can imagine from that dichotomy that you describe, you know, where there are occasions where you push back, but all the other times it's basically being a punching bag for somebody's frustration, it sounds like. And that, yeah. I can see intellectually how, you know, you can say to yourself, you know, this isn't about me. This has nothing to do with me. It's really just about this person's angst, frustration, you know, issues that are unresolved and so on. But still, if you're a sensitive person and you're taking that in, you know, that's got to be taxing.
Mm. Well, I'm not taking it in. Because then at a certain point, you're like, you know what? Like, the shipment got delayed a day. This person spent a lot of money on something and they're upset. I can completely understand that.
Right.
And on the one hand, you know, people could be like, well, they're being irrational. But then on the other, it's like, no, like, I have empathy with that. And like, I'm not going to just dismiss someone's feelings and like potentially tank a relationship just because like, I don't want to get yelled at.
Mm-hmm.
Like I, like having that empathy too with artists and with clients is really important because yeah, like people are spending a lot of money, like, and something going a little bit wrong, most people wouldn't freak out, but some people do. And like, you have to kind of be flexible enough to allow for that. And, you know, I'm not going to internalize it, but I just, you know, like if someone needs to scream, like, okay, go ahead and scream, you know, that's fine.
What's a typical thing that could go wrong? I mean, from this outsider perspective that I have, something that comes to mind is, oh, they didn't get the piece that they wanted, you know, that there were like 10 pieces available and they wanted this piece one, but that was already gone. So they had to get piece two. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Is it like that?
That happens a lot.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then people who, you know, want something and it's just not available and then they start screaming. And I mean, one time, We have a few artists that people are very, very hot on, and so there are like waiting lists. And one collector,
I think I know who it is,
called and like basically likened one of the directors to Donald Trump because he couldn't have a certain piece that he wanted.
Wow,
that didn't go over so well.
yeah,
that was a little excessive. That's the kind of thing that that's when you don't tolerate it, and that's when that person can go away.
Has it? I know there probably isn't room for this in your, you know, in your mindset for your job, but has it ever crossed your mind that this could be an opportunity to put some distance between a client and their entitlement?
I try to check people's, and well, no, I don't. I think that I try to be gentle and I try to, like, you know, there are a lot of artists that people want and they're like, I want this. And I have to say, well, you know, I totally understand. You have to understand there's a waiting list. I'm going to do my best, but like, you can't buy something that doesn't exist. And that's something that I try to make clear to people in the nicest way possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that I've definitely noticed, like, people run into where it's like, well, I have all the money in the world. Why can't I buy this painting? And it's like, well, because you can't. There's a line of people ahead of you. You have to wait in the line, or there's a million, you know, like there are 10 institutions that want to buy it. And there are only 5 paintings. All the money in the world is not going to buy you something that it's maybe A, not right for you to buy. And that's sort of something that we guard. And B, like, you know, we play fair. We don't just sell to the highest bidder. We're not an auction house.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very loyal to clients that have been good to the gallery and good to our artists over time. Like, the thing that gets rewarded in the art world that I inhabit and that I want to work in and the one that I will continue to work in is the one where, like, relationships matter, loyalty matters, caring about artists, about galleries, about the people that you work with and the way that you behave when that matters. Like, that's the thing that that I want to perpetuate.
Right.
And that I try to perpetuate in my relationships with clients and things like that.
Right, right. We're talking right now on the 24th of August, and I only mention that because, you know, it used to be in New York that pretty much most of the galleries took the whole month of August off. You know, now I think there's a lot more activity going on. But even still, like at the end of August, like sort of the last week of August and then, you know, into Labor Day, that seemed to be the deadest time of year. And it sounds like for you, correct me if I'm wrong, you're still kind of working. So I'm just wondering, you know, we don't have to get into the details of what your current schedule is, but just generally, if you're working, you know, if you're sending, dealing with client emails at 11 p.m. on a regular basis, you know, and you're working 7 days a week, how much downtime are you getting? How much time off are you getting? And, you know, and how are you managing that over the course of the year?
It's definitely quiet now. The last 2 weeks of August are pretty quiet. I am still, like, sending offers and things. I have a lot of vacation days to burn. So personally, I took a little vacation in July and was still selling stuff during that. But I'm a workaholic, too, so I was sort of happy to do that. And now I've taken, like, a bunch of four-day weekends this month. I'm still sort of working from home when I'm not there. It's definitely quieter. I still am emailing a few clients here and there. But it's a lot of, like, prep work for the coming months. You know, fall is coming up. A lot of art fairs are coming up. It's sort of taking this downtime to prep as much as possible. One person in particular that I worked with a long time ago likened working in a gallery to trench warfare, where sometimes it's a lot of, like, sitting around and waiting. And then at other times it's just, like, all hands on deck, like, you know, things are just going nuts, and it's being able to inhabit both of those situations that's sort of key. And knowing that this, you know, you're not really sitting around and waiting, you're just, like, you're just getting ready for the next wave,
right,
the next battle or whatever.
Do you think it requires workaholism to, for, you know, having a long run in the gallery world?
And the certain kind of ambition, and, you know, I'm only just starting now to, like, maybe turn my phone off for a few hours a week, like on a Sunday at night. And that feels good. But I also, and it's a very personal thing. Like, I love working. I love what I do so much that it doesn't really feel like work to me.
I see.
You know, like, on my downtime, I go to, you know, I hang out with colleagues and I, you know, still hang out with artists. It's not like on a certain level, I sort of don't know how to interact with people outside of the art world, to be honest, because I don't really know what to talk about with them.
Oh, well, that's kind of sad. That's a little sad, don't you think?
It's kind of funny. It's just like, I think that we speak a certain language or we live a certain kind of life. And I mean, I have friends outside of the art world, but it's very different. And, I love living and breathing it. You know, it's fun for me.
Right.
Work is fun. I love going to art fairs. As sort of soul crushing and exhausting as they can be, there's still, like, a real, you get a lot of adrenaline from it. I love closing sales. I love going to artist studios. I love making sales for artists, and that, like, that thrill and that rush just makes all of it worth it.
Okay. Sounds a little addictive.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Better than heroin, though, I guess, right?
Yeah. You will get no pushback from me there, for sure. Is there maybe one other story related to an artist that you've worked with that might be interesting to go out on, as far as what you realized about the relationship you have with them or something along those lines?
You know, artists who are hungry for galleries, they're hungry for that. And then there are artists in galleries who are hungry too, and there's no, like, there's not necessarily a moment where you're set. And to, like, I want to make sales for artists, and when something doesn't sell, like, that, like, it's not just a blow to the artist, it's a blow to us too.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, and it, I mean, I, it's like, you know, I'll be sitting at an art fair sometimes where I'm looking at a painting that I think is, like, one of the best paintings I've ever seen, and no one's looking at it. And to have to go to an artist and say, oh, it didn't sell, like, that, it sucks for them, and it sucks for us too, because, like, we're heavily invested in them. I mean, we're spending money going to a fair, and we're spending our time traveling, and we're spending all day, like, sitting in a booth talking to people about this work, and, like, we're not doing it just to make a buck, really. Like, we're doing it because we believe in the work. And so, like, that's, I think, what we were talking about when it was, like, emotional investment. It's like,
yeah,
I feel it too when something doesn't sell,
right?
Because, like, I can't, you know, it's like, why, like, what, you know, what's wrong with people that they don't want to buy this, that kind of a thing. And it's not to do, you know, it sometimes just has nothing to do with, like, it has nothing to do with sales technique or whether or not a piece is good. Sometimes it's, like, just not what people are buying in that moment. And it totally sucks.
Mm.
And it's really, really hard to have to accept that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Know, I mean, I can,
whatever.
It seems that if I were in that situation, I would wonder, you know, you made it clear that it wasn't an issue with the sales, and it wasn't an issue with the work. It was almost something to do with the timer or something. And so I would ask, one of the questions I would ask myself is, maybe this isn't fitting into, you know, the buying trend right now, or maybe I just need to, this is not the right context or something like that, if it's an art fair.
I mean, you know, the market, there are trends, obviously, and there are things that sell easier than others. And, you know, there was a moment where abstraction was a thing. Now it's like figuration is a thing. At another point, figuration will fall back away, and I'm sure abstraction is going to come back. And, you know, it's never, you know, but it's always like, well, but I would never tell an artist, like, well, you know, figuration is really the thing right now, so maybe you could make something with, like, a person in it. Like, that's awful. It's just a matter of, like, weathering through it and
right.
believing in an artist and knowing that, like, okay, it's not now, but that doesn't mean you're going to drop a person.
Yeah.
Like, Anton doesn't drop artists. That's not, like, it's a lifelong commitment for him.
Mm.
And that's another thing that I love about the gallery. It's like, okay, it's not selling now, but, you know, it's still great. Like, we're still going to do this. Like, we don't just do shows to be commercially viable necessarily. We do them because we believe in the work, and, you know, we try to sell the hell out of it. We try to sell the hell out of our boobs. But the thing that's important is, like, the art and sort of trusting that the sale will come and doing your best. But, you know, sometimes, I mean, it takes years sometimes for people to really recognize the brilliance of an artist, and then, well, they can't buy it fast enough, and it's like, oh wow, you know, could have bought these 10 years ago at a much cheaper price, but
right.
Hey, you know, now people, you know, sometimes it takes showing it for 10 years for people to finally look at it and go, oh, this is brilliant, you know.
Yeah, and that actually goes back to a question that I wasn't able to ask, just because I didn't want to interrupt the flow when you were talking about the waiting list type situation, you know, starting with a collector, you know, anecdote that you mm-hmm. referred to, but, you know, how everybody mm-hmm. wants this artist, and they particularly want this particular piece, but they at least want that artist. And I was wondering, do you feel that it's the case that sometimes collectors are frenzied because there is a frenzy? You know what I mean? Because it's like the momentum just spreads, and they have to have that artist, a work by that artist, just because they're caught up in that frenzy?
Oh, absolutely. There are plenty of people that just follow trends or,
mm-hmm.
and then there are plenty of people that will look at those trends and go, oh, well, like, that's not, you know, there's a million different kinds of artists. There's a million different kinds of collectors. There are people
sure.
that just buy what they love because they love it, and they don't care about the value. There are people that want sort of like trophy pieces.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that respond to painting. There are people that respond to sculpture.
Right.
It's all very, collecting's a really personal, visceral right. thing a lot of the time.
Right.
And you know, I'm not dealing with like people collecting like Damien Hirst. That's a sort of different echelon of collectors. I mean, some people that I work with do have Damien Hirst, but it's not, you know, we're not dealing with like multi-million or billion-dollar sales. And so it's really very, very personal. And I mean, you know, I collect. And so it's like, I understand that like mentality a lot of the time. Like, I'll never try and convince someone to buy something because it's a good value or a good investment. That's like rule 101 of like what not to tell someone. Because it's not true and you can't predict the market. And that's not the reason you buy something. Unless you're like a billionaire and you want to flip a Picasso, which at that level, like, that's a totally different level than your everyday collector. That's like the 0.01% of collectors that do that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of us just do it for love.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. I really appreciate it. I appreciate your really being honest about the challenging experiences and you know, and what it's like doing what you do. Thank you.
Of course. Yeah. Happy to share. Thanks.
You bet. And
all right,
we're out. Thank you so much again to Brigitte for talking to me. I hope you guys found that enlightening and not too upsetting as far as some of the realities that she has coped with or been challenged by. If you have any comments, of course, feel free to weigh in via email, via the website, via social media, whatever you feel comfortable doing. You can even leave a phone message on the podcast hotline. And that number is 424-256-6618, if you are so inclined or motivated. All right. So before we get to the Weiss links, I do want to remind you this is a listener-supported show. And you know I'm always haranguing you at the end of the show for helping the show out financially. And here is an excellent opportunity to do so because Marcus Sivin, an artist of great standing, the new chair of the art department at University of Nevada, Las Vegas, as I said, has donated four of his works. I'm going to just give you a brief rundown in case you're not online right now. They range in size from a little cardboard and paper piece with paint that's 7 and about 10 inches to, on the large end, a piece on a sort of black painted heavy paper piece that has then white chalk on top of it, figurative imagery that is 27 by 19 inches. The other two, there's, again, I mentioned there's that sort of painting. It's a like a painting on paper is what I call it. That one is 11 and a half by 10 and a quarter. And then the fourth one is sort of a collage with cutout paper, paint, and colored pencil. That's 8 by 13 inches. They're all 2011. And all you have to do to get one is donate to the show. You could donate as little as $20. And you could come away with one of these things. It all depends on how many people donate over the next couple of weeks. You can donate via PayPal, via Patreon as a subscriber on an ongoing basis, or you can donate via Venmo. So any of those options are available to you. And simply whoever donates the most between now and, let's call it, either the next episode or, if we need more time, the end of the month, will get first crack at these pieces by Marcus. So great way to own some artwork for very affordable prices, potentially. And thank you so much in advance for supporting Marcus, supporting me and the show and everybody who helps it out. Thanks to everybody who's been helping out. And so, of course, you can support the show non-financially by spreading the word, getting people to subscribe yourself. Follow on social media at Artist Podcast, and you can leave a review on whatever platform you use. Of course, they tell you about iTunes and that being a great place to leave a review so more people can find the show. So thank you in advance for that. All right, let's get to the Vice links for the week. Here we go. And we're going to end with the one about Damien Hirst, and it's written by alum of the podcast, Tim Schneider, once again making an appearance. All right, so here we go. This is from Hyperallergic. Artist infiltrates back-to-school shopping displays with bulletproof vests. If you strolled through the clothing sections of a Los Angeles superstore in the past week, then it's possible that you've seen a strange new item on sale. A Across the city, the street artist known as Plastic Jesus has planted child-sized bulletproof vests in the displays of popular back-to-school shopping destinations like Target and Macy's. Wow. Has anybody picked one of those up? If you have, if you're an LA listener and you pick one of those vests up, I would love to hear from you. Headline of the day. This is from the Art Law blog. Museum boss fears Philly insect heist was an inside job. That's it. That's the end of it. And finally, from Tim Schneider, courtesy of ArtNet, a decade after Damien Hirst's historic auction, resale prices are looking ugly. No matter how you feel about Damien Hirst's work, his place in history is secure, and his era-capping single-artist auction, quote, beautiful inside my head forever, unquote, deserves a healthy share of the credit or blame for that. Beautiful Inside My Head Forever could hardly have turned out better for Hirst. The evening sale boasted a sell-through rate of 97%, and the two-day auction as a whole generated just shy of $201 million in sales, trouncing its high estimate by $24 million. Using the ArtNet price database, I tracked down 19 lots from Beautiful Inside My Head Forever that have returned to auction in the time since. The chart below compares their total sales value in their debut with the total sales value they generated in their first respective resale. The question looming over Hirst's career today is the same one that Beautiful Inside My Head Forever first surfaced. Is demand for his work growing, or has his market largely shrunk to a group of pre-existing stakeholders continuing to protect their investment? Instead of a formaldehyde tank, the best fluid measure here is a bloodbath. After enticing buyers to spend $8.1 million at Beautiful Inside My Head Forever, the same 19 works only managed to bring in about $5.2 million after they each mounted the auction block a second time, a collective loss of nearly $3 million. Below is a chart showing each of the top 10 beautiful lots by sales value that have returned to auction and the change in price when the hammer fell on them the second time. In summary, only one of the top 10 works sold for a higher price when bidders got their next chance at it, and the gain in that case was an anemic $38,500, about 7% above the original sales price. The others lost between $92,000 and $656,000 each. So again, thanks to Tim Schneider for that. And I guess, you know, I'm kind of not a big fan of mentioning big name artists, especially this one. But when it comes to a little bit of schadenfreude towards some of the collectors in this world, and again, as Brigitte pointed out, there are a million types of collectors out there, just like there are a million types of artists. You know, you can't still help but feel a little bit of schadenfreude towards collectors who bought in on that whole Damien Hirst scenario and got burned a bit. Nesba? All right, that's enough burn for this week, this episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. I hope to hear from you. I hope to get some bids and some donations on those Marcus Sivin works. Thank you so much in advance, and I will talk to you in a couple of weeks. Ciao for now.